Mr. Ellis, Reel 1. Can you tell me what you were doing when war broke out, please?
Yes, I was working in a shirt factory in Southend-on-Sea.
Is that your hometown?
No, it was the place I lived at that particular time.
What is your hometown?
Southall, Middlesex.
And what was your reaction to the news that war had been declared?
Well, as I was a young man, the first thing I wanted to do was to get in the forces. But at the time, we were evacuated out of the area, as it was became an area for potential invasion, and we moved to Bedfont in Middlesex, where I was put to work in General Aircraft Limited. That's where I started my engineering career.
Where is this place?
Bedfont in Middlesex and General Aircraft at Feltham, which was the original London airport, Hamworth.
Were you in any of the bombing in 40-41?
Not in 40-41. In 43, we were completely bombed out ourselves at Bedfont. We lost our home. We had quite a miraculous escape, in a way. I was by then in the forces. My father went into hospital on the Friday, and my mother and younger brother, who normally slept in the house regardless, that particular on the Saturday night, went out and slept in the shelter on the road, and that was the night our house was completely bombed.
Where were you when it was bombed?
I was at Milton Hall in Peterborough.
But you missed the earlier Blitz in 40-41?
No, we had it. We were on the outskirts of it every night. We had alerts from 6 p.m. until the, well, normally about 6 in the morning as well, I suppose. We had quite a bit of it where I worked.
But did many bombs fall in the Bedfont area?
Quite a lot of incendiary stuff. They were after the aircraft factory, and later on they were after the anti-aircraft battery that was behind my home. That was how we got bombed.
Do you remember any particular buildings or streets that were badly hit in your area?
Yes, in Longford Road, three houses had a direct hit and about 9 people were killed from the one bomb one night. The factory at Feltham had one complete bay completely knocked out, bombed and firebombed, which was later rebuilt. In the locality, not a lot more.
How much was public morale affected?
Oh, by the ordinary bombing during that time, public morale to me was never affected at all. We used to at work have the amber and red signals. And we never took any notice of the sirens at all. We just carried on. And we had the roof watchers who, if there was any activity coming immediately our way, then we used to duck under any local shelter that we could find.
And was your own work part of the war effort?
Oh, yes. Yes, I was doing various parts on aircraft construction. converting hurricanes to go on the merchantmen, where they catapulted them off of the merchantmen, and then that was the end of them. Did a few bits and pieces on sea fires, Spitfires.
How much pressure was there on you on behalf of the war effort?
Oh, quite considerable, really. We were doing 7-day week, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., and then one day off. And, we got on. It wasn't until about mid-1942 that pressure went off. In fact, it went the opposite way. We went on to waiting cards for months. Had nothing to do at all.
Waiting cards?
Waiting cards. That is where you got paid your basic rate and you just sat around doing nothing.
What was the motivation whilst the pressure was on? Was it patriotic or extra pay?
Oh, both, I think.
Was there a lot of money to be made?
No. We took home, by standards then, probably a lot of money, but it was only in the region of about £5 or £6 a week, whereas the normal rate would be about £3 a week. So there were no huge sums of money involved.
What was the name of the factory?
General Aircraft Limited.
And it was at Feltham?
Yeah.
Was there any such thing as industrial action or strikes?
Not there. Just before I got called up, 40 of us were mobilised as a specialist team to go over to Chrysler's at Kew, who were having trouble there with some bomber fuselage construction. And when we got there, we were just told that we were no longer anything to do with General Aircraft. Our money was cut by tuppence an hour. We were just people to do as we were told, and that was it. The unions tried to come in, and they just shut them out the gate. And threatened us with a prison and what have you if we didn't do as we were told. Anyway, we found out there that there was rather massive sabotage, more by ill discipline than by serious intent to impede the war effort, I might say. But it ended up with every fuselage that was built by the people on the site being scrapped. We had to break them up with sledgehammers and that, because they were so far out of true, they were in danger. We proved that the jigs were all right, because we built one complete fuselage. All this happened in a period of 2 or 3 weeks. And the end result was that the local labour manager, the manager of Chrysler's, about 6 AID staff and a couple of others, all went to prison for various years for impeding the war effort. And all 50 of us got our call-up papers. I should say that I had been trying for a couple of years to get into the RAF as a pilot. That's the only thing you could volunteer for from a reserved occupation. I'd been to my aeronautical selection board, Oxford, and I got turned down with eyesight. I had conjunctivitis. And thanks to this period of inactivity on waiting cards, I managed to cure this conjunctivitis. I'd been to hospitals and what have you. And I kept on pestering the recruiting office at Acton, and the flight lieutenant there got to know me well, and he arranged for me to go out and see the RAF ombudsman for eyesight, who was the last word with any of the flying crews who got turned down by a medical board, and he passed me fit. And I had the call-up papers along with the other 50 on the Tuesday, and we were all told by General Aircraft, who knew all about it, bring them all in, they'll all be scrapped. But I didn't particularly want to go back into industry, I wanted to go in force. And on the Thursday I had my RAF papers, but I couldn't go into the RAF because I'd be a deserter from the Army. So I went into the Army, and...
Just before we take it any further, if I could ask you a bit more about, was it Chrysler's at Kew?
Chrysler's at Kew, yes, the car manufacturers.
Are you saying that because of the high-handed attitude of the management, that the workers deliberately messed up the job?
No, there just weren't the skills there, and there weren't the disciplines to make them do the job properly. There was enormous amount of sheer stupidity there. We had never seen anything like it in the aircraft industry. There was where you put sections of fuselage and that together, you use 1/8 diameter rivets. They found, because of misdrilling or misplacement of the things, that these didn't line up. And they were using what we call bodgers. And they were putting up to 1/4-inch diameter rivets in the holes that they bodged with these spikes to get them together. And the centre section of a Lancaster bomber was about 6 inches out from front to rear. And that's over about 20 feet, I suppose.
Why were they so incompetent?
Presumably bad management.
So it was the fault of the management, not the workers?
That's right. Oh yes, I think in any terms like that, certainly where we were in a proper aircraft company, the inspection just would not allow anything like that to go on. The management would have to see that the workers were using the jigs right and got the thing correct.
Did you see the management? What kind of people they were?
Not really. I can't remember them offhand now. They just don't mean very much. In fact, to be honest, my best recollection of Chrysler's at Kew was their canteen, which was marvellous.
So they were better at serving food than making fuselage.
They were indeed. Yes.
But was it a very young management?
I would have said it was middle-aged from what I can remember. You know, when you're only 20, 21, something like that, people over 30 can seem old to you and that. I would have said they were probably in their 40s.
Now, coming on to your Army career, can you tell me how you came to be in SOE?
Yes. I was in the Royal Armour Corps training at Barnard Castle as a driver operator, which meant that principally I was a radio operator. And I had been out one evening on scouting business. I used to do a lot of scouting in my younger days, and wherever you went in the Army, ex-scouters tended to go to local troops and keep them going, because there were very few resident scouters in being, and that's, you know, we used to keep the scout movement going. And I'd been out this evening, and when I came back, it was literally like a swarm of bees coming in the camp, and this was after lights out and excitement. And I had a particular friend there who hadn't been out with me. He was still awake, all right, as most people were. I said, "What on earth's going on, Jock?" "Oh," he said, "they've been recruiting down in the canteens this evening for people to do special jobs." Now, I might add that most of us in basic training were a little bit browned off, I suppose, that we weren't seeing any action, and volunteered for everything, you know, whether it was paratroopers, commandos, Palestine police, what have you, anything except the job that was in hand. And so I said, "Oh, so did you put my name down?" "Oh no," he said, "we could only put our own names down." And apparently everybody had put their names down. So in the morning I was, you know, saying rude words, and the hut corporal turned around and he said, "Well, you can report on adjutant's parade this morning and put your name down." So, fine. And I did that thing. And there were seven of us on that parade, and the adjutant, a Major Lord Butler, he turned round and he said, "Now, this is what I like to see. Lads who don't go diving in head first, but make mature decisions after sleeping on it." He said, "I'd be delighted to put your seven names forward," and turned round and tore up the other 2,000 names that had been done the evening before. We seven then were sent down to Henley-on-Thames, where we were given the Official Secrets Act to sign, and then a Morse test.
When was this?
This was the end of 43, towards, where were we? No, sorry. This would have been in July 43, I would say. And told that we would be going in behind the enemy lines, possibly by parachute, possibly not, for radio operating. And that's all that could be told us. We were tested, and we were told that if we did not hear anything within 3 weeks, then forget it. Those who were wanted would be taken in that time. So the 3 weeks went up, and needless to say, the seven of us in the camp were keeping tabs on one another, and one suddenly disappeared. And nobody else, so we said, "Oh, well, that's that one written off, you see." And we carried on our training. As it happened, it went from primary training to field regiment training. We changed over the training platform. And I was home on my second embarkation leave when I got a recall back to Barnard Castle. Nobody knew where I was being posted. My corporal swore that it was to the photographic corps, because I was interested in photography, and that was that. And the four of us went, and we had no idea what it was, and then we all tabbed up what we'd volunteered for, or this, that, and the only common denominator was this one at Henley. And sure enough, eventually we ended up at Henley, where we then had further selective tests, living with psychiatrists, intensive radio training. Quite a lot of chaps fell out. A whole load, about 300, were formed into a forward recce units, and we ended up with I think it was 70 of us, as Jed well, we were only troopers then, everybody who went into SAE on the signals had to drop all their ranks. I mean, Ron Briley, for example, who, you know, he was a substantive sergeant before he went into JEDS, but he had to drop that rank and come in as trooper, the same as the rest. We used to get up to some hijinks there. We met the Fanny for the first time. Quite an experience. And after...
You met her?
Fanny, F-A-N-Y. Personnel of Fanny.
Any particular one?
Not really. There was one, but we cried that quits because of the job. We were informed, incidentally, at Henley that the job now entailed probably 90% fatalities. Still didn't seem to worry most of us, so we carried on. Now, these Fanny personnel came in mostly from girls' high schools or...
Public schools?
Public schools, yes, thank you. They came there in civilian girls' clothes, and once they knew us, and that was very quick, they just behaved like young school girls. They used to climb the trees and everything else there. And then suddenly they got fitted out with their uniforms, and they became the proper little madams that they were. When I say that, we had a most peculiar relationship. I don't think that any of the Jeds ever formed a romantic liaison with any of the girls. I came as near as anybody. We always treated them like sisters, and they treated us like brothers. And we found that worked for the rest of our time in SOE. Didn't matter what part of the world we were, we had their priority as brothers. And of course they were doing their radio training there, and that was when we learnt really not to get too close to them, because they were going to be on the home base transmitter receivers. And although we spent weeks with the Creath machines to try and iron out our individual Morse signatures, it just wasn't on.
Why not?
There are one or two gifted radio operators who can change the style. I've only ever met one in my life. But everybody else is Morse, is just like handwriting. I mean, so much so that when I was in France and made my first sked to London, strictly against regulations, but then we didn't go much on that at time, the operator on the other end, at the end of the transmission, J-E-I-M-I, you know, John Ellis question. I just put Y and A-F, I-M-I, L-X, loving kisses, you see. We knew one another straight away. Yeah, we hadn't worked together for months.
What was the name of this machine you said? Creath?
Creath.
Creath.
Yes, it's a punched tape machine that you punch all your morphs out on it and then run it through, and it will automatically send out the dots and dashes or message that you want.
How did you find the training? Did you have any problems with it?
No, training there was quite good. We used to have a sergeant who used to try and snap us up occasionally. He ended up in the ditch. We threw him into the ditch. By then, we had got to a real comradey batch. We'd been split into two batches, incidentally, of about 36 each. One had gone elsewhere, and we stayed at Henley. And we used to say, return to unit, the whole lot of us, you see. They tried to transfer us all into the Royal Corps of Signals so as we would get trade pay, because we weren't getting any trade pay in the Armoured Corps. And we said, no, we don't want to go in no Corps of Signals, we're Armoured Corps. So they eventually came up and said, right, we're going to give you B3 rating on signals, and you'll get trade pay for that, extraneous to that.
Who else was on the course with you? Which individuals do you remember?
Oh, can I have a look at my list? I can. Yes. Well, there was Fred Bailey, Saul Bassett, Ron Briley, Arthur Brown, Ned Carey, Jim Chambers, Jim Edgar, Jack Grinham, Frank Harrison, Blondie Holden, which is Alf Holden, Glyn Loosemore, John Sharp, Harry Verlander, Boxer Wild, an old mate of mine, Neville Wood, there are a few. Oh yes, Teddy Cornick, of course, was there, and Jess Gardner.
Can you tell me about forming a JEDBRA team in your case?
Yes, we were all at Henley. We suddenly had the OSS NCOs join us, and the French, who later become lieutenants operators, joined us. And this was purely for about 3 days. And then we all transferred to Milton Hall near Peterborough, where we all became sergeants. The Yanks became master sergeants, the French became lieutenants, and there the officers all came in, and they mixed together for 2 or 3 weeks, and we did more physical training and arms training and various things like that, and our ops training. And then the officers had got together, and they had formed the pair of officers who were going in. In other words, it would be a British officer and a French officer, or an American officer and a French officer. Common native.